some of his experiences at Fort Bliss.
So you arrived with the first group?
I was I did not arrive with the first group at Fort Bliss. I was supposed to go first together with von Braun to the United States, five or six of us, to prepare things and then...
Documentation and so forth?
Yeah, I think Mr. Rees was there and Dr. Fridetsky was there, I think.
Right.
And so this group was split up, Dr. von Braun and Mr. Rees came to Fort Bliss, and then Mr. Neubert and others came to...
William Schulze, I guess.
Schulze, came to Everdeen Proving Ground. Mm-hmm. So we stayed from our arrival date, about 15th of November, to Christmas at Fort Strong in Massachusetts. And then about five of us were brought to Everdeen, Maryland, to sort captured documents.
Oh, you were involved in that?
And, yeah, and secondly,
Popo was there.
Then Walter Riedel and I, it was Riedel
3,
we were asked to give lectures, so to speak, to the first U.S. guided missile school. Yeah.
Oh, really?
We started out there. So we...
I mean, at Aberdeen?
At Everdeen. And
I
we
see.
Gave lectures there, which we were put in report form, and was the first, I would say, teaching material textbook used in Fort Bliss. Of course, again, there people put a lot of effort in as time went on, and they got some very, very good textbooks, but the first one, they just could derive mathematically quickly and presented it,
mm-hmm.
and had debates with Dr. Kent at Everdeen, Maryland, how we did this and how we did that, and so on. It was a very enjoyable time. We had one of the officers who was a captain who gave us, I would say, American colloquial lessons and so on, yeah, because we had all, I would say, either had 7 or 9 years of English in school, but we didn't have, I would say, so to speak, the routine which comes from using it, or we could read it and so on. And, but one thing which helped us quite a bit was reading Reader's Digest. It was, I think, presented in a way, everything, and edited in a way that we had no problems to read or understand it. Yeah? But we every now and then we got newspaper from particularly the southern part of the country, which generally contains more French words of French roots, yeah. Like the difference between storm and tempest, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The French word is tempest, French is tempête, yeah. And the English is, and the German is storm or storm, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so these types of things, there were newspapers, let's say, coming from Louisiana and New Orleans, we hardly could read, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But while we could read the New York Times, and those newspapers had no problems. Of course, the longer you are here, you get also acquainted with the other words more and more, so it doesn't make any difference. But in the beginning, it was a problem. And then we had difficulties to follow pace, and someone told us something, we understood the English, but then we had to think, what did he say? Yeah, what did it mean? Yeah. In the meantime, the individual started talking on, and then we didn't get the next sentence or so. But these things, after a quarter of a year, are mostly overcome, and we had no more problems. So in March, and I arrived in Fort Bliss on the 21st of March, and we rode in a train from, it was from Everdeen, Maryland, to Chicago, and then went another train from Chicago to Kansas City, and I saw the first time Kansas City, Kansas and Oklahoma, the flat areas and so on. We rode the train all day long, and we saw a few houses up on the hill. It was just about...
You wonder where you were going, I guess.
Then we came to Dallas, Texas, from Oklahoma, and then on the... And the train from Texas to from Kansas to Oklahoma City, and then also Panhandle, down to through Alamogordo, and the Alamogordo was
the, that way, yeah.
Yeah, was the first place I saw the first green trees, yeah.
Yeah.
On the 21st of March, yeah. And you could see really on the day the spring break out, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that came of course to Fort Bliss, and we were in former station hospital annexed. The whole area was fenced in, and we were told the fence was not for us, but people who were undesired out. Yeah. The army was very much afraid if the population would find out that we were Germans up there, that they would lynch us, yeah, after the war. Yeah. But we haven't really found any hostility or so.
That was all just conjecture.
And, yeah. So we needed a few things and which we couldn't get into PX, and so there was ever times we had the group divided. We had about 120 people in groups of five, yeah, and this in 6 days. Four groups of people every day up away, part in the morning, part in the evening, so that there was no concentration, and the guards were told that, or the accompanying GIs, that should never lose one of us, and so whenever we were somewhere, they told us, okay, stick together, you said, I don't lose. And then the GI said, okay, now go in here, buy whatever you want, and be down here again, and half an hour, I'll meet you here again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he probably had a date there somewhere, yeah. And so we did our shopping, and some of us got out to a restaurant and had a beer or something. And
right.
Then most of the time, then the people said, okay, why don't you buy us lunch here in the part of the North Hotel, and then you go and do your shopping, and then we meet at 5 o'clock here again, and so on. Mm-hmm. So it was very... So the people in El Paso, they saw all the time these, barely English-speaking strangers there, accompanied by one GI, yeah.
I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. So we went and bought all kinds of things also for our wives, because they couldn't get anything in Europe really or San Diego.
Yeah.
So it's it, and actually we were on the per diem, our salary was paid in Germany to our families. We had a per diem there, and so half of our per diem we spent on packages we sent home. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was for this, and then we were called to Vicenza when the first V2s came and helped them.
Were you involved in getting those set up for lunch?
Yeah.
What kind of shape were they in?
Some were really beaten up, you know, they were put on the truck and then. Mm-hmm. Then brought from Nordhausen to Havre in France, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And these people who drove and never had driven a missile and so on, yeah. I think we got about 100 of them. I think we put out of the 100, we disassembled and repaired them and could sort of get about 40, yeah.
40.
And the rest was probably, damaged beyond repair. We even ordered in Germany of the plant to produce spare parts.
Oh, you went back to some of the old
industries? Sure, the American occupation forces arranged all this, and we were permitted.
Did you go back yourself to coordinate it?
No, I was not. There were a few others going. Yeah, I went.
Who did go back on that?
Oh, let's see. I think Reese was once.
Reese?
Reese knows this much better who was with him. These were actually people out of our assembly plant, four men, and so one got all these compressors we needed to get the oxygen plants going, mm-hmm. and so on. And, so this all worked out really well. And
so you were physically at White Sands with that same group?
Yeah, we normally lived at Fort Bliss, but there were some barracks where we could sleep in, so we had our rooms there, so we could come anytime.
And so, of course, I got the charge for the range safety, and we had one case where a missile was hitting, heading right towards where we had our observation post for the range safety. Yeah. And they had given, a Navy man, an enlisted man, a sailor, who was supposed to push a button. He had to push a button only in my direction. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when this missile came, he said, "Shall I push?" And I said, "Keep your hands off. Shall I push him?" And so on, and I had VIP standing around, and the thing was really looking like it was heading right for, it was, somewhere between 100 and 150 feet, and I knew it was spinning wildly, yeah, and that keeps it in the same direction, yeah, because whatever the control system does, it's neutralized in that one.
I see.
Spin, so I didn't get concerned at all, yeah, and... So when I looked around, there was only the trembling sailor standing there, yeah, wanted to push a button, and I said, "For heaven's sake, keep your hands off." Yeah. And then it impacted on the end of the airfield, the control field. Didn't do any damage and so on, but then all my people who were with me on the stand, they came back again. There was one, a Navy commander, he said, "You know, I've never seen such a cold-blooded fellow." I knew what was going to happen.
Right.
If it would fall down and explode, he couldn't get away fast enough anyway. So
yeah.
All the same.
Hang in there.
So I think it was a good thing that's a man. I could tell him, "Don't push it," and so on. And, no, this the same was when this was going to Fort Bliss. There the control system did fail maybe after it was flying for maybe 15 to 20 seconds. It was already through sonic speed, and we had tilted the trajectory such that it hit, the flight path angle at burnout of about 5 degrees, which bordered about... 40 miles far, and
mm-hmm.
was impacting again at the wide sense range in the, I would say, in the near field, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And these things look like they go really straight up, and there is no point which is the azimuth there. So if you have stood there for a while, you really don't know, is it really in the zenith, or then I suddenly felt it was moving really towards the other direction.
Yeah.
Up here towards the, you go real big and see
what's
it
going
so on. Then I decided if you can see this already, it's moving that way, it's really building up speed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so my conclusion was if you can let that thing burn out, then nothing can really happen anymore. It produces a big hole, but it does not, put the whole city blocks on fire.
So you want to get rid of the propellants, huh?
Get rid of the propellants,
right.
And I figured I really evaluate the trajectory at the time when I really saw it was going through zenith, And I would have pushed the button, The nearest point that the missile would have fallen would have been all these wooden barracks and so on. You would have seen the fireworks there.
Yeah.
You couldn't really...
You made the right.
And if I would have pushed it a little bit later, it was still going very steep,
Mm-hmm.
And, so the impact point was moving at probably some, during the burning period, 5 miles a second south. Yeah.
You were doing some quick calculating.
I decided, let it burn out. Yeah. And of course, I realized that it would then possibly go into Mexico. I hoped if it ever gets into Fort Bliss, that there is no more fuel in. Yeah. I could not have saved the house, but I could have saved the city block that way. And
It
just went over Juarez, and Juarez, it is half wood, and a thatched roof, like that. That would have burnt like tinder, yeah?
Yeah.
And,
so it actually went beyond Juarez. Went a little
beyond Juarez and impacted on the corner of a cemetery, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And we got onto cars and so on and got down, and by the time everyone was notified, an American people from Fort Bliss got there. What did they find? Yeah, the Mexicans were all collecting pieces of tin around skin and so on, and had a hamburger stand there and were selling, I would say, souvenirs and hamburgers there. And I said one day to some reporter, you know, that was the first a commercial use of space.
Very good. And the first...
So I think they sold the whole empty weight of the vehicle was about 4 tons, yeah,
mm.
10,000 pounds. But I think they sold maybe 10 to 15 tons of relics of it.
Everything. Did you bring the engine back across the border?
Oh, the engine is impacted, so it was only small pieces. Yeah.
You didn't bring anything back?
No, it was...
Just let them have it.
Yeah, they sold everything. Yeah. Everything what was metal, yeah, that was sold as pieces of it. Yeah.
I wonder if any of that still exists. I guess someone must have.
Well, probably the engine may went the hole and you can't see it, yeah, because it really has penetrated and it goes right on the door. Later on it, yeah, and unless you dig it out, and it will be completely flat, yeah, whole engine compressed to about 4 inches thickness, yeah.
Well, now the rocket that landed in Sweden still had a pretty good chunk of engine, didn't it?
Yeah, but that was where the warhead came off, yeah, and it fell down by itself, and the missile came in a flat spin and comes down like a parachute, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So my large parts are undamaged, really,
right.
Or slightly damaged, yeah.
What was your reaction to that particular flight?
Oh, yeah, this was quite interesting, too, yeah. I noticed right away. This was... there was a V-2 missile, but with a Wasserfall control, the prototype control in it. And we, in order to test it, we had worked out a program, and we told the man who had the stick control to memorize it. Yeah, so he had to go, we computed this all, so and so many seconds to the right and so many seconds to the left. We had all figured out that, so to speak, it would then fall down again in the line of fire after maneuvering, yeah. And this man was so excited that he applied all the corrections the wrong way. And this way it did not come there, yeah. There's earth rotation involved, it's displaced by so and so much, by earth rotation it goes the other way, there's a heading the other way and so on. So
all added up.
I told the man, you know what you did? You just did all the commands with the wrong sign. Yeah, that's some real, respect first. That the man probably did this with intention, but I noticed he was so excited that it couldn't have been done. And so I said, okay. Can have fallen into Sweden. Yeah, we set our target so close to the Swedish coast. Yeah, because we could then determine the impact against landmarks and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Nobody. We said now it has done too far to. Right, we could also not aim it. The normal rocket in any. But we had to go, with certain points on our launching table, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not actually on that day change the azimuth. We only rotated it to 90 degrees, yeah.
Okay.
So to go over in that direction instead of falling along the Baltic seashore, because if it would have strayed, the chances that it fell on land with this, test was much larger than do it the other way and just fire past these islands there.
Yeah.
And, And so we decided to do that. And so I told my people, you make an immediate evaluation of all the data, where it fell, so that, and let me know so that I can report if something happened. Yeah. And so when I got the data, people said, it looks like it has fallen into that canal between Karlskrona and these islands, yeah, mm-hmm. just in between. Yeah, mm-hmm. There was about a 10-mile wide.
You hope you hit the water, in other words.
We hope we hit the water, but the main that our uncertainty is about 6-7 miles, so it can have fallen on land.
So did it run on and the coastline?
Just about 2 or 3 miles inside. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you immediately from Sweden that this would happen?
Yeah, and there was immediate feedback to the German, foreign ministry. Mm-hmm. And they called immediately, and I was, while I had asked my people to check now more accurate, yeah, because I felt I could not really get anyone excited and we had not really hit something, yeah, mm-hmm. and if we wouldn't get anyone excited, no one would have noticed it, no one would ever know about it, yeah. We, of course, would tell our bosses and tell them where it is and so on and so forth. Would have submarines and divers going there to try to get it, but for heaven's sake, don't say anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was flying in one of these V-stall aircraft we had, these Fiedler Stork, yeah, mm-hmm. and over to that little island on which we had also some firing there, and when I was there, the commanding general said, Steinhoff, did you fire into Sweden? I said, sir, it might have been. I have had all the analysis done, and it looked like that the impact was in that water area. But of course, the uncertainty is so much, if we don't get more data, that it has it's there on there, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then you immediately...
He said immediately, no, it can't really be, yeah. Then he went back to the telephone and said, yes, we had that case, and it is possible that it has come down. And said, in the meantime, I thought that it had actually landed near Karlskrona, yeah.
Someone heard the impact, I guess.
Yeah. And they probably had the case when it broke up, that is a quite a sonic boom, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then of course the impact more, you get like an earthquake, yeah. Mm-hmm. But you can say if sonic boom, if it's near, it's so sharp, yeah. It's you really don't know what happened. Yeah.
Were you aware that the Swedes turned the parts over to the British?
Yes, we
were aware of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you try to make any attempt to get them yourself before the British?
Oh, we. I know it's actually the border past Bornholm, yeah. And
is there some plan to maybe try and grab them or recover them?
No, we there's a following. There was a 50% chance that the vehicle impacted as a whole, and then we couldn't say anything of the parts. And,
yeah.
Then if it broke apart, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then there were several parts that could be flown or anything, and we didn't think we should interfere with Sweden's neutrality in a sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, that was a key link for the British
bombing
of Peenemunde later,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, we counted after this was known and so on here that the British got any word of it, that we really were expecting it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hey, that's great.
Occasionally, these things drive it. Of course, the VD itself, or the actual vehicle, Wiesmann was in charge of the documentation and people working for him in this
world.
Called Wiesmann, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's just retired.
Yeah. Oh, he's much too young to retire.
Only 50 years?
Everyone tells me, yes, should not retire, but I want to finish a number of books here. If I don't,
you want to go on annual leave to the United States, but otherwise with the 2 or 3 soldiers and us 7, it was an empty airplane. Yeah, we drove and we're flying over, what do we call that Portuguese island, Azores?
Azores, yeah.
Yeah, we flew over
Azores. You left from Paris, did
to the Azores.
To the north.
And then to Newfoundland, then to Wilmington. And in Wilmington, we got a new airplane. The home base of the airplane was Wilmington, Delaware. And from there, we chartered a small airplane and went back to Boston.
Fort Strong.
Yeah, to Fort Strong. Yeah, to the airport and from the boat to Fort Strong.
That's it.
Yeah. And then we went for Strong. There, 2 days later, 3 days later, who showed up? Dr. Muller and Dr. Meyer. And they couldn't believe it.
You beat them over there.
We beat them over there. We beat them over there. When this little boat came on the landing pier, yeah, he was really, that how is that possible? But anyway, suddenly we were there, the floor was over, and Major Hamill, who should pick us up, was sick.
That's it. Had you met him before?
No.
No.
And Major Hamill was sick, and we had to wait for him. They didn't have a substitute and so on. We waited 10 days for, 8 or 10 days for Major Hamill to pick us up. And he showed up after he was not sick anymore, yeah, and then he drove us at night, and he told us not to talk to people, and he drove us at night to the railroad station. We went to the back entrance of the railroad, and then we drove to Aberdeen.
That's, going back to Fort Strong now, were you interrogated for 10 days, or what did you do?
We didn't do anything. We were eating, learning English, and walking.
And walking.
And walking, yeah. We walked around.
Yeah.
Look, there's a little island and so on.
Seven of y'all together.
Yeah, this is Dr. Meyer and they teach us a little bit about this diesel engine and so on.
Oh, Dr.
Von Braun teaches us in English and so on, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did there.
Was he pretty good in English then? English?
Oh, yeah, he was pretty well in English at that time.
And then Aberdeen, you start looking at documents.
In Aberdeen, we left four people who stayed in Aberdeen.
Yeah.
Five people in Aberdeen. And Dr. Race went through to White Sands,
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Von Braun stayed in Washington with Hamill. But I think Race, I do not know, maybe he stayed 1 day or 2 days in Aberdeen.
But then he went
back straight to White Sands, bypassing Washington, I believe.
Yeah.
And we five people, we were suddenly confronted with a lot of documents.
Who was younger? Was he one of them?
Youngert.
What was his background?
He was manufacturing.
I see.
He was came out of manufacturing. He was a master.
Where is he now? Do you know?
Youngert could not stay with us since he had a girl. She got sick, you know, and what do you call that? Grippe in Germany, brain grippe, and she got crazy when she was 11 years old, and she had to they had to put her in an institution, and he had a choice to leave the girl in Germany, since the immigration law, you cannot bypass the immigration law, you cannot immigrate with a girl like that.
Mm-hmm.
They said we have no choice, we cannot afford it, that she's in Germany, and we have to pay for it, and for that reason, he went back then. After 1 year.
1 year. So that was the five of you, manufacturing, ground support, mechanical and propulsion would be Schulze, I guess.
Mechanical propulsion, and Norbert was astronics, and Dr. Schwedetsky was measurement.
What did he finally end up now?
He's with General Dynamics.
He went to industry.
He went to industry. He's General Dynamics. I think he's with Conway.
And of course, Schulze is retired.
Yeah.
So really, you're one of the
older. Norbert and myself, as I left the group. Yeah.
So, would you tell a little bit about the experiences there with the documentation? I think that'd be a fascinating story. But they were in boxes, I guess. Brought over from Norway.
They had boxes, what they found in this salt mine.
In the mine.
They told us about 40 to 50 tons. And what's American is, when we arrived there, there was one officer in charge. It was
was Tesman with you also?
No, he came in the next group.
Okay.
But we first, we were for 2 months, we were 5 years alone. And they had some American GIs, but were former Germans, and so on. They talked to a very good German. But not so good in English,
yeah.
But they helped us to bring order in this thing. Mm-hmm. Most of the time they opened it, the box, and dumped it on the ground. And that didn't, naturally we didn't prepare, we prepared it only for us. We didn't prepare that the American would totally take it over, yeah?
Yeah.
There was no key to the drawing system, no key to the report system.
Just a so random collection.
Yeah. No, we collected everything. But for a stranger, he could not fit it together.
That's it.
And we naturally know all the numbering system, we know the reporting system and so on.
Yep.
We could put it together.
Was the objective to put together complete V2 documentation, yeah, to build V2s? Was this the idea?
Our order was to bring it together in a shape that people can look at it and can find it.
Find it, yeah.
A separated waterfall,
right,
from development item,
yeah,
V2 from the A5 and so
right
on, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what we did in all the weeks, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody was, like nobody, went to the reporting file and we got all the reports together.
Right.
Once in a while, since drawing filing is not a, it's quite a boring item, yeah?
Yeah.
For that reason, we switch a lot of time. This is why maybe
three,
4 days, somebody was on the drawing file and got the drawings together. And some of the drawings, you know, they're 12 to 15 feet long, yeah?
Yeah.
And they were all old and we had to put them.